This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Bell Junkie, school is in session. This is Junk Food Cinema on FilmSchoolRejects.com, the weekly nerdy film cast all about cult and exploitation films that is so good it just has to be fattening. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and I'm joined, of course, by my friend, my co-pilot, my partner in crime.
The Lieutenant of Megaforce.
Lieutenant of Megaforce. And novelist and screenwriter, well, all the other stuff. Apparently, we're just focusing now on the Lieutenant in Megaforce. Mr. C. Robert Cargo.
Hi.
Hi.
It's summer school edition.
It is summer school edition.
We are talking some of our favorite teen movies this month.
Which one of us is Mark Harmon, then?
Well, probably me, because I'm the young at heart guy that's really far older than the roles that he's playing.
Wait, I thought the role you played on the show was the curmudgeon, so I think you're exactly the right age for the role that you play. Well, that's just me. That's just what I'm throwing out there. I want to remind you guys that you can catch the show on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. Of course, you can always find it at FilmSchoolRejects.com as well, but you can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema or like the podcast on Facebook, Facebook.com/, you guessed it, Junk Food Cinema. And I did want to let you know, if you are planning on attending Convergence in Minneapolis this July 4th weekend, we will be there doing a live show, a live performance of Junk Food Cinema. That is July 3rd, 7 p.m. So if you are attending and you're listening to this, or I don't know if you can, I don't know if tickets are even still available. I don't know how that works, but I just want to let you know that we'll be doing that, and we'll probably be broadcasting that live here on either on Film School Rejects or on Ustream, so keep your eyes open for that. You know what? I also thought we could start doing, Cargill. I'm gonna float this idea past you on the air, because that's the best place to workshop ideas.
Ooh, a floater.
A floater. I'm going to leave you with a floater, Cargill. I think what we should start doing, since we do a lot of themed months, and once again, we are starting a new theme with this episode, but I would like to give people the opportunity to play along at home, if you will. So what I was thinking we might do is actually we'll start with our first subject, but we'll let people know what the next few weeks are going to hold, so that if you haven't seen these movies, you can go watch them, and then when you listen to this episode, you'll have more of a grasp of what it is that we're talking about.
Oh, yeah, no, I've been down with that idea for a while. I've been, I thought you weren't a big fan of that.
No, I'm fine with it.
Oh, yeah, no, we're both on the same page there. There's no reason to keep it secret.
Or safe.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Keep it secret. Keep it safe.
So we are doing...
Ah, you fools!
You shall not pass. You shan't. You shan't pass. We are doing a theme...
Paul Blart Mall Cop! None shall pass!
We're never going to get to the actual point of what I'm saying.
Why would we get to the point of what you're saying?
Just going
to
keep quoting Lord of the Rings, because why not? Anyway, we're doing teen movies this month, teen comedies.
Some of our favorites. Not all of them, though. There's just too many to fit into a month.
Although, I was pleasantly surprised that there are 5 Tuesdays in June, which means that even though our last theme kind of carried over into June, we're still going to get to do 4 whole episodes this month. So,
But had we not carried over into June, then we could have fit in She's the Man.
Yep, I'm still pleased. Today we're
which you have not seen, and you may watch and go, holy shit, this is actually one of Amanda Bynes' watchable movies,
dubious.
And I like it.
I am dubious. But we're going to start this week with, we'll tell you that in a minute, but the next 3 weeks will be 10 Things I Hate About You, will be Sky High from 2005, and we're going to finish up with The Last American Virgin.
Which must mean that tonight is...
I can't hardly wait to tell you.
Oh, one of my favorite films of all time. Not one of my favorite
movies.
This is one of my favorite films of all time.
Wow. Well, see, when we were in school, when we were school age, this time of year was really important because it was the start of the summer, it was the end of another school year, and there was so much promise, so much optimism. You know, we were going to have all this freedom. And it's for this reason that we have dedicated this month to, you know, the shows we're going to be doing about teen comedies. And we're starting off with Can't Hardly Wait. Which is quite fitting, as Can't Hardly Wait is that movie about the last party, the last hurrah after graduation. Yeah. So graduation for a lot of people out there has already happened, and we're going to talk now about Can't Hardly Wait. But I'm interested to know, Cargill, why is this one of your favorite movies, not just teen movies, but favorite movies of all time?
Well, and I
always... if you could make your answer an hour long, that would be great.
Well, we can do this. no, you know, the thing is that I've been a big fan of teen movies for a long time. I mean, I love a good, well-written teen movie. You know, there's, as you notice from the list, there's no John Hughes on there because, well, frankly, if you are not well versed in John Hughes, you probably shouldn't be listening to this this podcast to begin with.
Also, I don't know anyone out there who needs to give a second glance, a second thought to a John Hughes movie, John Hughes teen movie. You know what I mean? Like, some of the movies I think we're covering this month are ones either people haven't caught or have a very idea of what the movie is. That, you know, warrants a second look at the very least.
Nobody
needs to go back and rethink how they feel about John Hughes movies. They're great. And yes. They were great the first time you saw
them. Yes. Yeah, no, and they're perfect. And they became the model. And, you know, the model kind of got lost in the late 80s, early 90s. And then with Can't Hardly Wait in 97,
I believe. 98.
Mm-hmm. It gave a rebirth to the model. It was the first time someone had attempted to make a John Hughes movie in quite some time. And it really connected with me. The big thing is that I connected with this movie, on a very personal level. And I'll give a little biography to this. When I was in high school and a young writer, I was experimenting with poetry, and I'd never written poetry until high school, and started experimenting with it. And there was this girl I was very attracted to, who I had never spoken to, who I had a locker next to, and I wrote a poem about her. And a friend of mine who read my stuff regularly read it, and he's like, "Dude, you need to send this to her." I'm like, "No, you know, blah 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 blah." Anyhow, it turned into a whole big debacle in which a bunch of my friends, you know, forced me into dropping this anonymous poem into the said girl's locker. And then, of course, it became a big thing of her trying to find out who sent, you know, who's sending her these anonymous poems, and which is one of the core conceits of this movie. So instantly watching this movie, it's like, holy shit, Ethan Embry is playing me in this movie, and his spinelessness is very indicative and very representative of my own spinelessness in high school. And I identify with this character wholeheartedly, where he has these very big, lofty ambitions, and he's like, he believes in these profound concepts of love and connection, and that are all bullshit. And that are really based upon nothing. It's this, he's in love with this girl that he built up in his mind who doesn't actually exist. And the real girl
twist
is someone else. And so it's really interesting. I instantly connected with this because that's exactly the situation I had. Like this thing, it's so rooted in truth. This character, this whole concept, this whole plot line has so much high school truth in it. And then they milk so much great comedy out of that. They milk so much great character out of that. And then around that one base plot line are built all these other great subplots that you are very much invested in, that you care about. All of the characters are fleshed out. Even the villains have three dimensions to them. And then it's completely populated by this young, hyper-talented cast that would go on to be superstars in their own right, mm-hmm. In the future, except for a handful of people who would go off to do other things.
Right.
And we'll talk about this, but it's such a wonderful pool of young talent put together in such a clever, wonderful comedy that, just like the John Hughes movies, have a lot of truth to it and connects to me because it's about the era and it's filled with the music that I was listening to at the time and that I was graduating with, and is, it really is the John Hughes movie for the late 80s, 90s era kids, and it just connected with me.
Yeah. And I completely get that. Although for me, I made more of a connection with Ethan Embry in Cheap Thrills, because when I was in high school, I once had to play a series of truth or dare games that ended in violence because I was strapped for cash. But that being said,
you didn't identify with Ethan Embry in Empire Records, where he eats the brownie and then Guar eats him?
That also happened, but that's a story.
Why don't you join the band, Mark?
I don't like to talk about that story.
Although that is yet another one of those. Like, literally, we could have done 3 months. We could have done the whole summer of just my favorite teen movies, and Empire Records would have been one on there. Mm-hmm. We may have to do Empire Records later this year because it's the 20th anniversary,
yep,
and it's one worth visiting, but it's one that sadly was right there on the cusp.
Mm-hmm.
But another good Ethan Embry movie.
Everyone take a drink. Yeah, but you know, you mentioned some of the people in the movie, you know, launching onto superstardom and some not so much. You know, I often talk about the movie Predator 2 as this weird waiting room movie where all the 80s mainstay actors are holding their breath to see if their careers are going to endure into the 90s. And I feel like Can't Hardly Wait is sort of the same thing for these 90s teen actors waiting to see if they're going to survive Y2K. I mean, it's literally the Can't Hardly waiting room.
Oh, yeah.
And what's weird is that a lot of these guys ended up moving into television. Like, yeah. I started looking around this cast, and I'm like, there are a lot of people in this cast that are now more remembered for the work that they did on TV than probably what they ever did in movies. Like, you know, you have Jennifer Love Hewitt moving into, like, what was it, Ghost Whisperer,
yeah,
I think was the name of the show?
Boob Whisperer,
Donald Faison in Scrubs, Seth Green moving on to Family Guy, Robot Chicken, even Melissa Joan Hart was only 2 years into Sabrina the Teenage Witch when they made this movie, and she had already been on TV with Clarissa Explains It All. There's like four or five people that are in 6 Feet Under, all in one movie.
and then you've got like people who have small extra roles in this movie. Who's the guy from How I Met Your Mother?
Jason Segel.
Jason Segel.
This is his first on-screen appearance.
Yeah. And in fact, the weird thing about his scene, we'll talk about his scene real quick. There are two versions of this movie, and I've never found the other version of this movie. I saw this movie in the theater opening weekend. And then the version for DVD, or the version on video, which would later be released on DVD, was different than the theatrical edit, and nobody ever mentioned it.
Hmm.
And I've not been able to find the footage, but I've seen the footage because I saw it in the movie. Jason Segel has a much larger subplot in the movie because the whole thing is about, his whole subplot is 7 months before he filled a watermelon with vodka, a small watermelon with vodka, and then grew it and put it in the freezer.
I filled this with 7 bottles of vodka last September. It's been in my freezer for...
And
that's what they look in the freezer and she freaks out about. Remember that scene where, like, when the woman,
that's not what she freaks about. Okay. That's supposed to be,
they never explain what the fuck is in that freezer, and it drove me
crazy.
It's
a sexual fruit sculpture.
How do you know? They never say that.
Because I saw the original theatrical cut and then never saw it again and remember these details. But so he puts that. But no. The thing is that what happens is he then explains to everybody what happens. Everybody starts reaching for it. It falls to the ground and shatters. So when you're watching the movie, all throughout the movie, everybody's eating watermelon. They're eating this vodka watermelon that ended up getting cut, which I don't know if it was an MPAA thing. I don't know if it was a studio thing. But I bought the 10th anniversary edition of this, hoping that it would be somewhere on there, hoping that it would be mentioned in the commentary, and nobody fucking mentioned it.
My guess is it has to be because of the MPAA. In fact, because one of the things that's interesting is that Charlie Cosmo's character, William Lichter, was supposed to be doing tequila shots all night. That's how he got so drunk. It wasn't the beer, it was tequila shots. And they had to change that because that put them in danger of losing their PG-13 rating.
Yeah.
So I would imagine the vodka-filled watermelon is probably the same thing.
But it was in the theatrical cut, and it was in the original trailers, because I've actually seen the scene. And my wife saw the scene too, and we were baffled when we watched it on video. We're like, wait, where's the bit with the watermelon? Like, that was really funny. Because Jason Segel was really funny in that sequence, but it doesn't exist. And maybe one of you guys out there knows and knows the little hidey hole where I can find this information. And if you do know, pass it along, because I'm serious. This is, if any of you who Google my previous top 10 lists whenever I was a film critic of my 10 favorite films, you will find Can't Hardly Wait on there, because it is really, honestly, one of my favorites. So collecting little minutia about it is a small hobby of mine.
I'm going to do a quick checklist called People You Forgot Were In Can't Hardly Wait.
Oh, let's do it.
First of all, I've already mentioned him, but Donald Faison is the drummer of Loveburger. We also have...
Loveburger! And who's the lead singer of Loveburger?
Breckenmeyer.
That's right. They would then go on together to be in appear in the follow-up film by these directors... the follow-up film by these writer-directors was Josie and the Pussycats.
Oh, boy.
And Donald Faison and Breckenmeyer would play members of the band du jour, along with Seth Green, where they were the boy band they were making fun of NSYNC.
Yikes. We have now mentioned Josie and the Pussycats.
Which is awesome.
Oh, my God.
Fuck you. That's awesome.
Oh, boy.
Fuck you. It's awesome.
You keep saying that. That's not going to help.
Have you watched it?
Seriously, can we get back to this one? Fuck's sake. Like,
let's go.
Put your boner for Josie and the Pussycats away.
Sorry.
Jason Segel, we mentioned. Clea DuVall is in this. Eric Balfour is in this. Selma Blair is in this. Jerry O'Connell is in this. We mentioned Melissa Joan Hart being in this. Breckenmeyer as well. There are all these people.
Oh, you forgot to mention... I'm blanking on his name, but he went on to be Twilight and essentially playing the same character as the older guy hanging out with all the teenage vampires.
Well, I don't think you can forget that Peter Facinelli's in the movie, because he's like one of the biggest characters. But yes, Peter Facinelli, for all of you who are just like absorbed with the Twilight film mythos, he is also in this movie.
I just found it really interesting that, you know, because here's the interesting connection for me with Twilight and Can't Hardly Wait, is in this movie, you know, Peter Facinelli is playing the king of campus. And he ends up, while at this party, seeing the previous king of campus who's gone off to college, who then gives him... the disheartening speech that, you know, this is the last great day of his life and this guy's pining for high school. And you see this moment where you realize this guy's peaked and it's all downhill from here. And then he goes on later on to play a vampire hanging out with a bunch of other vampires who all are living in high school perpetually.
Yeah.
They all look 25, but they're all going through high schools for some apparent reason that is completely inexplicable.
Yeah.
And so I just love the idea that he becomes the leader of a clan of people who all pine for their high school lives and live as vampires, reliving their high school glory days for the rest of eternity.
Wow. That's upsetting. I mean, it's apt, but it's upsetting to think that Mike Dexter was so desperate to stay in high school forever.
He gave himself over to an eternity of blood drinking.
Yeah, he became immortal and decided to be the leader of a clan. Dr. Carlisle Cullen.
And Carlisle?
Dr. Carlisle Cullen. Oh, my God. See, now I don't even want to talk about Can't Hardly Wait. Now I'm just like, fuck it. It doesn't matter.
Oh, no. We're getting deep into Can't Hardly Wait today. We are balls deep in Can't Hardly Wait this week. I'm still giddy. I love the fuck out of this movie. So continue.
Yeah. I think, you know, most of the movies that we're going to talk about this month are... 90s or 2000 movies that have a lot of nostalgia for the 80s. And this one actually, apparently the basic concept that they came up with is that the writer-director team on this noticed that all of the teen movies in the 80s had those great party scenes. Like, there was the one or sometimes multiple party scenes, but that's what the movies were really about. So they were like, what if we just did the whole movie at the party scene.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what we get here. There's so many 80s, what we call boner jams, that are just teen sex comedies, and they always have at least one. I mean, you can go to, like, Weird Science, for example, has a pretty epic party scene.
Oh, yeah. Revenge of the Nerds.
Yep.
Sixteen Candles.
Yeah, absolutely.
It is a trope of those. And instead of having a party scene, it's a pseudo party scene with Ferris Bueller's Day Off, where instead they have a whole parade party.
Yeah,
which is an epic parade.
Well, and even Breakfast Club, like, they're locked in one room and they still have a party in that room. Like,
yes, and then break the laws of physics and shatter a window and smoke out, and yeah, that's an epic party scene with five people. It's great.
Exactly. Dancing with yourself and all that. Yeah, I mean, that's one of the mainstays of an 80s teen comedy, because that's one of the integral parts of being a teenager. So I totally get that, but I think it's funny that they noticed that trend and decided to push it to the next level, where it's like, oh no, the whole movie's a party. The whole movie is just that party. And there's so many storylines going on at one time in one place that, in the hands of lesser writers, we would have had at least a couple of those thread lines that just petered out and didn't have a satisfying conclusion. But for me, in my opinion, every single storyline in this movie, even the ones that don't necessarily need to have a satisfying conclusion, have a satisfying conclusion.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, this is such a smartly written teen film. I believe that this is every bit as good as the John Hughes movies, but I feel that this one's slightly funnier and more satisfying than most of them.
Oh, wow.
Now, I say most of them because I feel that The Breakfast Club is the best serious teen comedy. I think it is the most profound of the teen comedies. But I think that Ferris Bueller's Day Off is easily the best and most satisfying. But I put Can't Hardly Wait right up there in that league. Like, it is arguable because of just how well this movie does what none of the John Hughes movies do, which is weave together all these alternate storylines going on at the same time and paying them all off.
Yeah.
And having such great small characters come in and being awesome. You know, Jenna Elfman, who you didn't mention in the list, shows up as the stripper angel for a really great scene with Ethan Embry. And of course, Jerry O'Connell shows up for that great walk-on scene with Peter Facinelli. And there's all these great just connections, and everybody has their own little, even the smallest characters, like the two X-Files nerds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they get a payoff in the middle of the credits that you're kind of like, oh, those guys.
Okay, all right. But they're really funny all the way through. You've got all of these, every single character has some kind of weird payoff and, you know, has an arc. Even Love Burger has a fucking arc.
They fucking come. What's one of my favorite scenes is they've only, as far as we can tell, only played this one party, and they've got t-shirts and they're hoping to, like, this is going to be their big breakout. They have a fight and they stop playing, and then toward the end of the movie, they're like, what would you guys think about doing a reunion tour? I'm like, reunion? You just walked away 10 minutes ago. Oh, my God. The
because
band's going to make
school
it. It's high
you.
School. The band is going to make it.
Yeah. There's even the douchebag best friends of the football players. They have their own arc, and they all have depth to them. Like, it's so weird how, and so perfect how everyone here has this, you know, has this kind of story and connection. The two annoying characters going around reliving high school that end up connecting with one another at the end. You know, like, everybody has a satisfying ending. And then we even get the super ultra satisfying National Lampoon's Animal House ending, mm-hmm. where we get the futures of everybody, which is so wonderfully satisfying. Like, everything about this movie comes together, and there isn't a wasted moment. There isn't a thing in this movie that you have to go, okay, you have to excuse that. Like, no, it all works. Like, the only thing you have to excuse in this movie is that it's a teen movie made for teens or people who like teen movies. And if you have your nose in the air about that, that's the only thing that's going to keep you from digging this movie.
Right.
Because this movie, is a perfect example of what a teen film is supposed to be.
Yeah, and it's smarter than... I'm going to say this right now. It's a lot smarter than most of the teen movies we get in anymore. It's smarter. The characters are more likable. They're more fleshed out. It's just... And it's funny because it might have been hard to see that at the time, but I think with the benefit of a little bit of hindsight and looking at the stuff that comes out now, it's like, oh yeah, again, not just with the satisfying resolutions to everybody's stories, but in the actual creation of these characters. As you said, even the jocks, even like the douchebag jock bully, has like multiple sides to him. He actually has a moment of heroism that he then immediately squanders.
Yeah.
It's like you can't ever get a bead on who this guy is because he's trying to live in so many different worlds, and that's ultimately his biggest character flaw. And, you know, the fact that you can actually have that discussion instead of, well, you know, he's blonde and he kicks the hero in the face, which is, you know, a lot of like the classic 80s teen comedies even where just like Billy Zabka's like Johnny Cobra Kai, for example, is not a super deep character.
No.
He wants to kick Ralph Macchio.
Fuck.
That's all he wants to do is kick Ralph Macchio. That's it. That's his whole lot in life is I just want to kick the little New Jersey kid.
Yeah.
Incidentally, I'm just going to say, Billy Zabka, after a conversation I was having on Twitter about just making jokes about what I would do if I ever met him, I was making a joke that if I ever saw him at a convention, I would just bring a body bag with Johnny written on it and just drop it at his table and leave. And then he started following me on Twitter, so I'm a little nervous about that. I feel like any moment, like, I'm going to be walking out to my car, and he's just going to kick me in the face. Or he's going to sweep the leg, probably. I am going to get my leg swept.
You haven't watched How I Met Your Mother, so you haven't seen the Billy Zabka episode.
Oh, I have seen the Billy Zabka episode.
Okay, yeah. I was going to say.
No, good stuff.
Because Billy Zabka was the Karate Kid.
Yeah, he was the Karate Kid. Who do you root for? The Karate Kid. It's a very tragic ending. Oh, my goodness. But yeah, one of the things I really do like about Can't Hardly Wait is that not only is it's nostalgic for the 80s the same way that like Richard Linklater's Dazed and Confused is nostalgic for the 70s.
Yeah.
And there's actually a lot of interesting parallels between these two movies, between Dazed and Confused and Can't Hardly Wait.
Well, I think that's intentional.
Oh, absolutely.
I believe that there's a lot
they're using
of
lines of dialogue. I mean, like, that's not an accident. They're using entire lines of dialogue from Dazed and Confused. And I think that part of what the inspiration for this movie was watching Dazed and Confused and thinking, well, what if Matthew McConaughey's character was not... Because there is a sadness to Matthew McConaughey's character, because though he's cool, you are very aware, you're very cognizant as an audience member.
He's running around fucking high school girls.
He's just such a sad person that he can't move on with his life. And I feel like the exchange between Jerry O'Connell and Peter Facinelli is like, what if Matthew McConaughey's character was allowed to be overtly a sad, pathetic character instead of one... What if he were self-aware? What if you had that moment in Dazed and Confused where he's just like, I get older. No, I just get older. It's terrible. I've wasted my whole life.
I get older and they stay the same age. And why am I here?
It's gross, man.
Yeah, it's just the opposite. But what's so great about... that's Woodhouse, right? Is that the name of his character in Dazed and Confused?
I think... I only know Woodhouse as the butler Wooderson? From Archer, so I should look that up, but yeah.
I want to say it's Wooderson.
Very likely that it's Wooderson.
But that's exactly... No, I feel like what happened was that, you know, these writers saw that and said, what if we took... was it Wooderson?
It is Wooderson, yeah.
Yeah, what if we took... that's what I get for living three blocks from where he shows up and does his thing.
You live next to Top Notch.
I live next to Top Notch, yes. No, I go to Top Notch. Fuck yeah, I go to Top Notch. Top Notch is excellent. And they have a little shrine to Dazed and Confused in there with the soul pole and an old VHS, and it's wonderful.
I swear to God, I think that one day I'm going to walk in there and Matthew McConaughey is going to be on the fryer. Just for no reason. Like, not that he needs to work there, but that he'll just show up and be like, you know what I've never done before is I've made onion rings. I want to make some onion rings. And he'll just be back there doing it.
I don't know. It's either going to be that or he's going to pull up in his Lincoln.
And drive around.
He's going to pull up and drive up and get some fries and some fried chicken, which is quite good. We should really talk to Top Notch about being a sponsor.
What we shouldn't do is record these on an empty stomach, because I'm feeling like that's why we're getting derailed.
Let's not. Anyhow, the parking lot of Top Notch is where Wooderson delivers his first line, which is the first line of dialogue that that he ever delivered as an actor. Anyhow, yeah, so I feel like they watched Dazed and Confused, and then were talking about it and processed it, and like, what if John Hughes made Dazed and Confused in the 90s? And what would that movie look and be like? And so they approached it in this way, because this is a movie that it was not slapdash. There's nothing slapdash about this. There's nothing that talks down to the teen audience about that, which is one of the big problems with teen films, is that people go into it going, well, teens are stupid and they want something stupid. It's like, no, if you offer elevated content to children, to teenagers, to adults, you offer elevated content in a genre that typically doesn't have elevated content, people will come in droves. And yeah, that's what this is. This is elevated content in the teen drama, in the teen genre. And so what these writers did was they wrote all these great characters with arcs, with great comedy. They cast all these talented young actors and ended up with a movie that really resonates and is still fantastic today. And that I honestly, without irony, hold up amongst the very best of the teen films, and is the one that I've watched more than any other teen film. So it is just everything about this movie works. And what we haven't talked about, holy God, the soundtrack.
The soundtrack is pretty outstanding with this movie. I think the one that really came away that I remember, the one that was sort of the music video for the movie, was Smash Mouth's cover of Can't Get Enough of You, Baby.
Yes, it's true. Yeah, well, this was just, this movie happened just after Smash Mouth hit. They had done Walking on the Sun.
Which is also in the movie, by the way.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, and that's the thing, is if you listen to Fushu Mang, the album that's on.
One of the first CDs I ever bought, by the way.
You bought that CD probably for the same reason I did, because Walking on the Sun was so great, and it's like, I want a whole album of this, and then you discover it's the only song in the album that's like that.
Yeah.
The rest of the album is really good punk.
Yeah.
It's great punk. Fushu Mang is a great album if you've never listened to it, but it's really good punk, but this was the only song to hit off it, and someone said to them, you know, if you did stuff that's more like in this vein, you could have a lot of hits, and they would just went, well, fuck it, we just want to play music. We don't have to play any kind of music. So all of a sudden they started taking the sound and putting it in pop, and they were really big for like 3-4 years, and then had gotten connected with all the people in Hollywood as a result of it, and ended up having, you know, hit the writing songs and doing covers for movies, and then becoming inescapable and becoming known as that band that everybody hated because they were the big sellout band. But this is right in there when they were really great. And the music for this movie is just, there's so much great late 80s, early 90s, mid 90s stuff in there. You know, Sneaker Pimps with Six Underground. You've got Tricky by Run DMC, one of our favorite karaoke duets.
Yep, this is true. They've got some Eve 6 with Inside Out. You've got some White Zombie with More Human Than Human.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and then, like you said, you got Bust a Move by Young MC. Funky Cole Medina's in there at one point.
Yep. This was the stuff that this writer-director team grew up with, which was the stuff I grew up with, and they were playing right to that age group. And they're like, let's mix some stuff that's really hip right now with stuff that was really hip 10 years ago but is still awesome, and it's so perfect.
Yeah, and of course, Barry Manilow. Because,
well,
Barry,
yes,
Manilow.
but the Barry Manilow gag is fucking hilarious,
and it gives the movie an exact date. Did you notice that the movie takes place on Barry Manilow's birthday? And given that the film came out in 1998, that means you can literally trace this movie to the exact day that it happens, which is not a very common occurrence for films. Films kind of take place in this exaggerated concept of time. This one's like, no, you know exactly what day this
movie was. What day was Barry Manilow born on?
Barry Manilow, in case you were wondering, he was born on June 17th. So that means that this movie...
That means that school got out really, really fucking late.
They must have had a fuck ton of snow days or something.
They really did.
Going on, because...
In California.
Barry Manilow's... And again, we're doing this in June, so this is very fitting.
Why you gotta waste my flavor?
Damn! So June 17th, 1998 is when this movie apparently takes place. So... Huntington High, I'm sorry that your school year ran over into mid-June. Or maybe this... No, because they say that this party happens right after their graduation ceremony. So, yeah.
That day. They graduated that day.
Yeah. Which is, you know, it's funny. We're going to be doing a theme here coming up about movies that take place. This could have also qualified for that, now that I think about it. Because it takes place within pretty much one 24-hour period.
It really does, actually. Yeah. No, it's a 24-hour movie.
But going back to the, just one more thing about the connection between this and Dazed and Confused. You remember that scene with Jason Segel where it's him and the other stoner guy and they're trying to describe to Jennifer Love Hewitt what Preston, Ethan Embry's character, looks
yes.
like. And they're just
kind of tall, but...
He's kind of tall and he's always wearing like...
T-shirts.
And she's like, so he's got hair, he's sort of tall, and he wears T-shirts sometimes. And Jason Segel's just like licking the crap out of this watermelon, which makes so much more sense now. At the time, I was like, that's really oddly sexual for his character to be doing over and over
again.
No.
He's trying to get every last bit of vodka yeah. Out of this frozen watermelon.
Actually makes a lot more sense now. But he says, this is fitting for two reasons. He says, you know who else I like that never got much play? Was Velma from Scooby-Doo.
Yes.
And the line that the guy uses is, she was a hip lady. That's an exact piece of dialogue from a conversation in Dazed and Confused. Yep. And not only that, but you know who Jason Segel was dating at the time of this movie?
No.
Linda Cardellini, who played Velma in both of the Scooby-Doo movies. So yeah, this is, it's just fitting for a number of reasons, but that is one of my favorite scenes in the movie anyway, and now that it connects to other things, just makes me love it even more. So yeah, the character we haven't talked about yet, of course...
There's a couple, actually.
I think we're going to have to talk about Special K.
Well, yes.
And we're also going to have to talk about William Lichter.
Of course, because William Lichter, as far as actors go, have the most interesting story in this fucking movie.
Charlie Korsmo, the actor who plays William Lichter... What's bizarre is that he, in real life, mirrors what happens to his character.
Yeah.
In that, you know, after high school, basically after this movie, he's never seen again by these people. Like, he did not act anymore.
No, he left and went to college and got, like, a PhD in something.
Yeah, no. It's remarkable. First of all, he hadn't acted since Hook.
Yes.
When this movie... So, 7 years, he had not... He was... By the way, if you didn't recognize him in Can't Hardly Wait, he's...
He's the kid from Hook.
He's the kid from Hook. He's also the kid from Dick Tracy.
Yep.
And he was also in What About Bob, which are three movies that I actually really like.
Two of those movies are good.
Okay. What About Bob is not a good movie, but I still like it. Don't worry about it.
Oh, wait. I think What
You're
About
Bob's
a good
movie. Dick Tracy? Really? Really?
Do I have to?
She's the man, yes. Dick Tracy, no. I just want to make sure I understand the barometer here.
Hey, no reason to bring
here.
Up She's the Man. We'll talk about She's the Man in the next episode.
And we're going to, you know what? And we're going to talk about Dick Tracy at some point, too.
Sure.
Because fuck you, it's awesome. Oh, okay, now I get it. Now I see. I see why the argument, fuck you, it's awesome, is actually
it's
meritorious.
It's a legitimate audience.
It's meritorious.
Yes.
As is the God
I love
it.
That I took you there.
God
I love
damn
that
you.
I, that you,
God
you
damn
went
you.
After me, and then you had to fall right back on it.
Dick Tracy is awesome. But the reason that he stopped acting after this is because he was attending MIT, and he is now, I shit you not.
K-E-Y-M-O-U. Oh, wait,
no, that's M-I-C. He is now an assistant professor of law and the U.S. director of the Canada-U.S. Law Institute at the Case Western Reserve University School of Law, where he also teaches corporate law courses as well as corporate finance. And what the fuck? Are you kidding? He was an actor, I shit you not, because he was bored in elementary school.
Yeah.
He decided he was going to be a movie star to pass the time. Who does that? That is remarkable to me.
Yeah.
So he's got, like, Charlie...
Okay, what kind of person goes off to study law and ends up teaching international law, but somebody who needs to have their brain occupied at all times. So, of course, that kid is not going to be fine just hanging out and playing video games. That kid's going to have to throw him into something, or else he's going to lose his goddamn mind
right.
and have to be medicated.
Right, but
and
there's
that's
like
how he did it.
There's miles of differences though between like stimulating activity for a child who needs constant. Mental stimulation, and just, I guess I'll go be a movie star for a while.
Well, he was never a movie star.
I don't know, man. Like, as far as kid actors go, like, even in the period of time where he wasn't acting, he was having big roles offered to him that he turned down. He was a fucking kid. Yeah. And he's like, no, I don't want to do that. And incidentally, do you know who ended up getting a lot of the roles that he turned down?
No.
Elijah Wood. Elijah Wood owes a lot of his career
to Charlie Korsmo.
Charlie Korsmo saying, I don't want to act anymore. Like, for example, The Good Son was a role that Elijah Wood plays in The Good Son was a role that was offered to Charlie Korsmo first. Yeah. And he was like, I don't want to do that anymore. And they're like, we'll give you $1 million, small child, to be in this movie. And he said, no, I don't want to do that. Like, he is just, he's a very interesting individual. I really hope that at some point we get to interview Charlie Korsmo, because I want to talk to him about this decision he made at a very young age to be like, no, I'm done. I've done this.
Really, as far as I know, he doesn't really like talking about this stuff anymore.
Enter Junk Food Cinema. We will find a way, Cargill, because we'll junk finds a way. But yeah, so his real life is a fitting parallel to his character in this movie, because as soon as high school is done, he goes off and does his own thing, something kind of completely unexpected, and you just never hear from him again. He's gone. And it's so odd to me that someone at that age, somebody that young, could just make the conscious decision, nope, I've accomplished everything I want from the acting world, and now I'm going to go be a lawyer. I heard at one point he was on, like, a missile defense project. And I'm just like, this guy is remarkable.
Yeah. No,
and of course, he's playing the geek in this movie, who has been the longtime punching bag of Peter Facinelli's character. But one of my favorite scenes is after Peter Facinelli's character, Mike Dexter, is completely humiliated in public and is just broken, and the two of them start bonding. Yeah. And it's this really kind of, like, touching moment, even though they're both trashed. Like, it's just a really touching moment where they're, like, they're actually getting along and becoming friends. And Facinelli has this great line where he's like, remember the time that you were going to give this big dumb speech and I tripped you on your way to the podium and everybody laughed? I'm sorry, man. He's like, hey, it's ancient history, water under the bridge. And he goes, yeah. When was that? Oh, that was this morning at graduation.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, yeah, that's right. So it's like, and then, like, in this beautiful little moment, and this is what's so great about the movie, is it doesn't just go with one direction, because immediately after that, you know, some things happen. Mike actually gets William out of a jam, and then when William tries to thank him, is a complete dick to him again.
Yeah, because he's around his friends again, and he's trying to play Mr. Cool.
And yeah. And I, you know, and of course we have to talk about Seth Green looking like a little hip-hop smurf in this movie.
Hilarious in this fucking movie.
Well, I got to have sex tonight. It took me all day, but I narrowed it down to a list of 10 very lucky finalists, you know what I'm saying?
He and the guys with him are just so fucking funny.
Yeah.
You know, and it's pure. Everything that's always been great about Seth Green is at the forefront here. He's super sharp, super funny, playing that, you know, white kid from the suburbs trying to be urban as fuck.
His senior quote is by Tupac. It's just picture me rolling.
Yeah. And it's, God, it's just so, he's just so goddamn funny. And every line that comes out of his mouth is fucking hilarious.
Yeah.
And, and he's just a big joke. But then, of course, you know, we find out what's really going on with him, and we get some great, you know, he reconnects with his old friend who used to be his best friend. And now, of course, they're both attracted to each other, and they were both kind of outcasts that went off their own separate ways. And it's really an interesting arc. It's really an interesting story. And just so fascinated by how he was handled and how hilarious Seth Green is in that scene, in every scene of this movie.
And it's funny too, because his interactions with Lauren Ambrose's character Denise really kind of illustrates how fleeting identity is in high school.
Oh yeah.
Cuz she is, you know, taking him down a trip down memory lane, like of, like, all these people they used to be, all these things that they used to be into, how they used to be really close, and then the things they went... And you realize, just in her remembering these things and recounting them to him, that what... You know, even though he's adopted a really obnoxious persona right now, it's one of many. And, you know, that whole idea that in high school you go through so many different identities, trying things on and seeing what fits, and... In his case, in this movie, his pants certainly do not. But I mean, it's just a really, I think there's a lot that's missed in that just because he is such an exaggerated character. But you've known, you knew people like that in high school. You absolutely did. And it's like, yes, they were obnoxious. Yes, they were ridiculous, but they existed. And I feel like his character in that movie kind of gets overlooked because of how ridiculous with the goggles and all the FUBU and the giant jacket and, you know, speaking in Ebonics that he clearly doesn't quite understand. But, like, when you take all of that away and really examine that character, like, it's actually a really touching, like, exploration of all the identities that we go through in high school trying to figure out who we are. And I think there's a lot of that throughout this movie.
Oh, yeah. No, and that's the poignant aspect of this movie. That the thing that I think really kind of borrows the most from Breakfast Club, that it plays on that similar concept of, hey, when you take all these kids who are very different and belong to all these different subgenres and slap them together, they eventually find out they're all exactly the same and that it really is just a facade that they put up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that we just do in high school to try to fit in. We imitate these certain subsections rather than being ourselves.
Yeah.
And even the people who are claiming to be themselves aren't really being themselves. They're being a facet of that. And this movie is all about all of that being stripped away and finding out who the people really are. And but it's done in a different way. Rather than forcing them all together like the Breakfast Club, they're willingly all together. And then, you know, and people end up pairing off in various ways. Like, you know, the one we were just talking about with Lauren Ambrose and Seth Green, they're locked in a room together. You know,
it's a bottle episode within the movie.
Yeah. And they can't get, and so they're forced to confront each other. And then you've got other people who are just kind of end up in the same room together and end up talking or, you know, end up wandering the streets and running into each other. And so, you know, you have all these moments where people are real to one another and the facades go away. And that's what I think is beautiful about this movie and elevates this film beyond just a stupid, fun teen movie. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of people thought it was upon release.
Yeah. And they all end up at Denouement Diner to have their last moments. I think it's funny that there's apparently an official hangout for the, like, next day breakfast after the party, because they go from booth to booth, and it's like, and now these people will have a resolution, and now these people, like, they're all at the same diner. It's just hilarious to me. Like, that was the designated hangout for after the party.
To be fair, you know, a couple of the proms that I went to when I was younger, you know, if you stayed out till dawn, you ended up at a diner where you had about a dozen different groups of people show up. So yeah, it's not unheard of, but yeah, no, all the major characters were at the same diner at the same time. So,
no, it's just funny to me because it's like clearly the next day and it's like, they're all kind of like, because first of all, two of the characters that show up at that diner spent the night in jail, which is funny to me. And then it's like, yeah, everybody just going from booth to booth is not only, you know, there, but having their loose ends tied down along with their eggs and bacon, and it's a lot of fun. I like this movie a lot. I think it's one of those movies that, you know, as we've been mentioning, doesn't get a heck of a lot of respect because, you know, maybe the characters are drawn a little broadly, but they're also given a lot of depth to them if you take the time to, you know, to if you spend the time with them that this movie wants you to. And this Can't Hardly Wait owes so much to 1980s party films, and, you know, those formulaic teen comedies about guys trying to lose their virginity or have one big bash before college, that if you listen to the song that plays at the end, It's Only You by Yazoo, which is a song from 1982. So you have a lot of the movie dealing with sort of like more contemporary music, a few like throwback party jams, but then for the movie's most poignant relationship moment, they went with a song from 1982. And I think that kind of says volumes about how much this movie owes its existence to, you know, the lineage of teen films that came from the 80s, to the party movies of the 80s. And again, it's just the party. It's all of the fat is trimmed out, and this is just the party.
Yeah.
That's what Can't Hardly Wait is.
Would you like to touch my penis? Huh?
So that brings us, of course, to our junk food pairing, and I think this may have been one of the easiest ones yet. It's the strawberry Pop-Tart. The strawberry Pop-Tart, much like in Cargill's story, forming a connection with someone whom you love from afar, is the heart of this movie. It turns out that the instrument of ultimate destiny, the vessel of Preston and Amanda's connection, is in fact a strawberry Pop-Tart. The very same breakfast pastry that I happen to be consuming at that moment, I believe is what Preston says. also happens to be my favorite flavor of Pop-Tart. So I now think that Preston's in love with me, too. I'm a little confused about how I feel about that, especially if it's the Ethan Embry from Cheap Thrills that's going to show up at my door.
It might be.
It might be. You know, I really want to not believe that Ethan Embry's character in Cheap Thrills is what happened to Preston down the road after him and Amanda split up, and he just, like, fell on hard times, met up with an old buddy, and then
they
all
didn't
of a sudden...
split up. It clearly says at the end of the movie, and they're still together today.
Well, yes, today being, you know, nebulous.
Whenever you watch the movie.
Yeah, well, we know when it started, we just don't know exactly when it ended. We know the exact date the movie takes place,
it
though.
It didn't. It was true love.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, of course. Forgive me
when
for being cynical.
When will I see you again?
Next week when we do another fucking show. Speaking of the show, thank you so much for joining us, guys. You can find us on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can follow the show on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like us on Facebook, facebook.com/YouGuessedIt, Junk Food Cinema. Please do use that Amazon link that we put up on the page in Film School Rejects. That benefits us. Even if you don't buy that item, just getting to Amazon via that link and buying anything benefits the show, and we really do appreciate that. Cargill, where can people find you online?
You can find me at twitter.com. /massaworm, that's MASSAWYRM, or on Facebook.com, Facebook/massaworm.
Excellent. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury. I have a Facebook page, Facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic, or you can always find me over at oneofus.net, my home away from home. A lot of great geek podcasts and blogs over there. We don't have a Greek one yet, which is what I started to say. I'm not sure. I guess great and geek just merged to be Greek.
Delta, Delta, Delta.
We should have a Tri-Lambda.
With Tri-Lambda.
Yeah, we should have a Tri-Lambda podcast that's just all about the Revenge of the Nerds films. It would be like...
Take a drink,
four
everybody.
Four episodes long. But yeah, thanks so much for joining us. And remember, guys, your perfect someone is out there. They're literally a breakfast pastry away.